Isaiah 3:1-3:26. The fourth talk in a series on the book of Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on September 27, 1998, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1998. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Now, in Isaiah, as I have already posited, I think that we are seeing three themes that are running through Isaiah, certainly the early part of Isaiah, and that is, first of all, Judah has been rebellious against God. Judah has been wicked. The nation of Judah, the southern kingdom. Secondly, because of that wickedness and rebelliousness, God is going to punish them. And that punishment will be a cleansing punishment. That is, it will be a purifying process by which a remnant of Judah will be cleansed, transformed, and will come to repentance. And ultimately, Judah is headed for a destiny. It has a destiny in front of it that is truly glorious. And this purification process is to prepare this remnant for that glorious future that God says is still awaiting Judah. Now, those are the three themes that I think are running through this section. What I hadn't fully realized until I started looking at Isaiah recently is that I think that Isaiah is just using those three themes, weaving them together in different ways and elaborating them on different ways, but he's taking those three elements and he keeps combining them in different ways to make an argument. And his argument is, therefore, repent. As a consequence, sometimes he'll talk about that destiny that's still ahead first, talk about the punishment, then talk about Judah's wickedness. Or he can mix it up and present it in a different order. But because of that, we have things that chronologically don't come one right before the other. We'll have things that are not in chronological order placed together. Isaiah is not interested in giving us a time scale on which all of these things will occur. He's just saying these things are out there in the future, and for these reasons, you should repent. And he will mix them up in a different order for different purposes, for the purpose of his argument at hand. To realize that's been very helpful to me, because before I'd always been confused about Isaiah's seeming confusion about the chronology of the end times. But I think, in fact, he's not really giving us a chronology of the end times. He's making an argument to the nation of Judah. And he draws upon these different things that are out there in the future for the purposes of the argument at hand. And I think we saw that last week, and I think we'll see that again today. In chapter 3, he's going to talk about two areas in which Judah has fallen short, two crimes. And he will also talk about two punishments, and the punishments are matched up with the crimes. In the Old Testament, it seems to me that that's not uncommon, that God matches up punishments with crimes. I will just use one brief example, the Tower of Babel. In the Tower of Babel, the people got together and they said, "Let us build a city and a tower that will reach into the heavens so that we can make a name for ourselves and so that we will not be scattered over the face of the earth." God said, I cannot allow that kind of arrogance to happen, to persist. I am going to judge this people. What was his judgment? His judgment was to make them all speak different languages such that they could not communicate one with another. And what was the consequence of that? The first consequence was they did not finish the tower. The second consequence was, rather than becoming famous, they became infamous. And they were indeed scattered over the face of the earth. So God made certain that the very things that they wanted to accomplish were inverted. The opposite thing happened. That seems to be a consistent pattern with God, to take our crimes and match the punishment to that. And I think that that's what we see in chapter 3. That's what he's doing. Now, the order in which he presents the crimes and the punishments in chapter 3 is, first, he gives you punishment number 1. Then he tells you what crime number 1 was. Then you're told what crime number 2 is and punishment number 2. Let's look at the first punishment. It's chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. For behold, the Lord God of hosts is going to remove from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, the whole supply of bread and the whole supply of water, the mighty man and the warrior, the judge and the prophet, the diviner and the elder, the captain of 50 and the honorable man, the counselor and the expert artisan, and the skillful enchanter. And I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them. And the people will be oppressed, each one by another, and each one by his neighbor. The youth will storm against the elder, and the inferior against the honorable. When a man lays hold of his brother in his father's house, saying, you have a cloak, you shall be our ruler, and these ruins will be under your charge. On that day he will protest, saying, I will not be your healer, for in my house there is neither bread nor cloak. You should not appoint me ruler of the people. So this is talking about a punishment that is yet to come upon Judah. And that punishment is apparently, first, Judah will be deprived of food and water. Now, it could be that what it's talking about is a famine and drought that will afflict Judah. And such a thing apparently did occur just prior to, not long before the invasion of the Babylonians. But it could be talking more specifically about a siege being placed on Jerusalem, by which enemy forces would prevent food and water from being available to the people of Jerusalem. All the fate of Judah was predicted back in the time of Moses. If you want to look at it in Deuteronomy 28, I think we start in 48, 49. Oh, we'll start in 49. This is, if you'll recall, Deuteronomy was essentially a restatement of the law that was presented to the descendants of Abraham at Mount Sinai. And this restatement was made to the people of Israel as they were just about to enter into the promised land. And Moses went through and gave a summary of the law. And then at the end, it proclaims a series of blessings if the Israelites are obedient and curses if they are disobedient. And in the series of curses if they are disobedient, in that section, we see verse 49. It says, the Lord will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand. So a nation of fierce countenance, who shall have no respect for the old, nor show favor for the young. Moreover, it shall eat the offspring of your herd and the produce of your ground until you are destroyed, who also leaves you no grain. new wine or oil, nor the increase of your herd, or the young of your flock until they have caused you to perish. And it shall besiege you in all your towns, until your high and fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout your land. And it shall besiege you in all your towns throughout your land which the Lord God has given you. Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you, during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you. The man who is refined and very delicate among you shall be hostile towards his brother and toward the wife he cherishes and toward the rest of his children who remain. So he will not give even one of them any of the flesh of his children which he shall eat, since he has nothing else left during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you in all your towns. The refined and delicate woman among you, who would not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground for delicateness and refinement, shall be hostile toward the husband she cherishes, and toward her son and daughter, and toward her afterbirth which issues from between her legs, and toward her children whom she bears, for she shall eat them secretly for lack of anything else during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you in your towns. So that's the fate that was predicted way back in the time of Moses, and apparently the fate that's being reiterated here by Isaiah in anticipation of that nation that's coming from afar. So they will be besieged, all of their food and water will be cut off, and then their leadership will all be taken away. The mighty man, the warrior, the judge, the prophet, the diviner, and the elder, etc. All of those people will be taken away. That is what Isaiah is predicting. And indeed, that's what the Babylonians did. The Babylonians, in, as in their standard practice, when they would conquer a land in order to make it impossible for the people of that land to rebel, they took away the leadership, and that leadership was taken, for the most part, to the city of Babylon, the Jewish leadership. So their leadership, their natural leadership, will be taken away. And what will be in its place? I will make mere lads their princes, and capricious children will rule over them, or the literally arbitrary power will rule over them. So what's going to happen to Judah is their natural leadership taken away, children will be their rulers. And with children as their rulers, there will be the absence of that kind of wisdom and farsightedness and value of things like justice that comes with age. All of that will be deprived of them. And as a result then, verse 5, and the people will be oppressed, each one by another, and each one by his neighbor. So in the absence of real leadership, there will be chaos. There will be anarchy. And the result of chaos and anarchy is oppression, not freedom. And the inferior against the honorable. The youth will storm against the elder, and the inferior against the honorable. I can't help but make a little side comment here. It's not known whether this is historical fact, but legend has it that when the British forces surrendered at Yorktown, the final surrender, that the British band, as the troops were getting onto their ships, played the song, a song that was popular at the time called The World Turned Upside Down. And as I study history, I am impressed with the fact that the American Revolution did begin a worldwide change which is continuing to our day. And what it did is it called into question who should rule. Who has the authority in a society to say what we should do? And the response that the Americans gave is that we are all equal. There is no hierarchy in society. And therefore, we should all decide what we should do. We should decide who should be our representatives and have that kind of input into who leads us. And it really was revolutionary. And I think I won't get into a discussion of what role America plays in history and whether the revolution was right or not. But I think that was a very serious decision that was made in the American Revolution with far-reaching consequences. And those consequences have not all been good. A similar thing is what Isaiah is talking about here, is the world turned upside down in an even more dramatic way. And that is, the natural leadership is gone. We are going to have children providing that leadership. And as a consequence, there will be anarchy and chaos. And we will have people taking advantage of others, people strong-arming others. We will have no justice. We will just have might makes right. And in the absence of that leadership, then, in that chaos, what's going to happen? They're going to turn to anyone who has any kind of distinction whatsoever and say, "Will you lead us?" Someone with a cloak. If someone has a cloak, they're going to say, "Aha! There's someone with something going for him. Will you lead us?" Because people can't stand chaos. And since we can't stand chaos, we'll just take any kind of order we can get. Any strong man. But the people that they choose and say, "Well, maybe you could lead us," there'll be reluctance. That person's going to say, "I can't, I don't have the resources. I can't do it. The state of our society is so bad, I can't save it. Don't look to me." So even though people are desperate for someone to provide leadership, no one with any sense is going to accept that position. So the leadership void will remain. It will not be filled. Okay, now from verses 8 through 15, he's going to explain what the crime was that called for this kind of punishment. And he's going to organize this explanation of the crime in a kind of strange way. So let me see if I can explain the way I see this fitting together. First, he's going to say, it's because you, Judah, as a whole, have been rebellious. Then he's going to somewhat soften that and say, you all were rebellious. You all are going to be punished. But keep in mind, there is also an individual responsibility and an individual judgment that comes. And he's going to talk about that briefly. And then he's going to say more specifically, the crime for which this judgment, this punishment is taking place, is the abuse of power by your leaders. Okay, let's go through it. Starting with verse 8. For Jerusalem has stumbled, and Judah has fallen, because their speech and their actions are against the Lord, to rebel against his glorious presence. The expression of their faces bears witness against them, and they display their sin like Sodom. They do not even conceal it. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. Say to the righteous that it will go well with them, for they will eat the fruit of their actions. Woe to the wicked, it will go badly with him, for what he deserves will be done to him. O my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. O my people, those who guide you lead you astray and confuse the direction of your paths. The Lord arises to contend and stands to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor? Declares the Lord God of hosts. So it's because Jerusalem and Judah as a whole have been sinful. Their speech and their actions are against the Lord. Both in word and in deed, they have been rebellious. The marginal reading I have, or verse 9, the main text says, the expression of their faces. The marginal reading is, their partiality bears witness against them. In other words, their favoritism, their lack of justice bears witness against them. And I think that's quite possibly what it means here. They display their sin like Sodom. We've seen that before, where Judah is being compared to Sodom and Gomorrah. But there is a sense in which their rebelliousness is on a par with that that was evidenced in Sodom and Gomorrah. They do not even conceal it. So there's even a pride in their wickedness. Woe to them, for they have brought evil on themselves. So that Judah is going to be punished because Judah has been wicked. Now, in the next two verses he says, say to the righteous, it will go well with them. So although Judah is going to be punished as a whole, there is also an individual judgment involved. And that individual judgment will depend on the person. The righteous one, for the righteous one, it will be well. So when it comes to the more important judgment, the more important assessment of a person, the righteous will do well, and the wicked, it will go badly for him. So on the one hand, there will be a corporate punishment that takes place, but on the other hand, the more important thing to keep in mind is there is an individual judgment that is yet to come. Then verse 12, his lamentation essentially. Oh my people, their oppressors are children, and women rule over them. Reiterating what it had talked about earlier in the chapter, this inversion. Rather than having their true leadership lead them, children are leading them, and it results in oppression. And women rule over them. Oh, my people, those who guide you lead you astray and confuse the direction of your paths. Then it talks about the more specific crime, and the more specific crime is the rulers abused their power. They devoured, it says, it is you who have devoured the vineyard. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. So the rulers have taken advantage of their power to enrich themselves at the expense of justice and at the expense of those under their rule. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the face of the poor? It's taking advantage of those who are powerless on the part of those who are powerful. Let me see if I can summarize what I think is happening here. Well, first of all, how can it be that Judah would be punished as a whole for the crimes of the leadership? I have thought a lot about that in thinking about history. In a democracy, it seems fairly clear that there is a connection between the leadership and the people. We elect them periodically, and we choose the kind of person that we want to have leading us. It makes sense then that Clinton is our president. We, as a society, chose him. We want him to be president. Not only did we want him to be president before, the polls, if the polls are to be believed, we want him to be president now. So there's a pretty clear connection between the quality of leadership that we have and the state of society as a whole in that kind of situation. It's less clear that that's the case in a monarchy, in a hereditary monarchy, What would make that connection? And I have thought about that quite a bit. And I remember reading a quote by Tsar Nicholas I of Russia. He ruled Russia in the early portion of the 19th century. He ruled Russia when Russia was the most powerful country in the world. And his title was Autocrat of All Russia. And he was an autocrat. In Russian tradition, the Tsar, the king, is more like a king in the Oriental sense than the king in the Western sense. In the Western sense, the king's power, in fact, was always somewhat circumscribed, because it was always believed that there are principles over the king that even he cannot violate. In the Orient, that's less true. And Russia, for a long time, was ruled by the Mongols. And in Oriental and certainly Mongolian culture, what the king said, that's the way it was. If the king said, "I don't like your face, take his head off," then someone would come and take his head off. There's no concept that there are these standards by which even the king must be accountable. Tsar Nicholas complained that he wrote decree after decree, but he couldn't get them enforced. Here we've got the most powerful man in what is the most powerful country in the world at the time complaining that he can't get his laws enforced. Why not? Because in any state, it takes more than just one leader to implement that rule. It takes a whole army of officials, of counselors, of bureaucrats and whatever, to carry that out. So Tsar Nicholas could only do what that army of people under him would allow him to do. He could write the most outrageous decree that he wanted to write, but if the people wouldn't follow it, it wouldn't happen. It would just be on paper. It's like Alice in Wonderland. The queen goes around, "Off with his head, off with his head, off with his head, off with his head." And they all come back with their heads on. They were never taken off. If the king cannot get people to carry out his will, he's powerless. I watched a Shoah. I watched Shoah several years ago now. It's the account of the Holocaust in Germany. It's a very interesting account. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to do so. It's very long, but it's very interesting. And it was done by a Jew who had been in Poland at the time of the Holocaust and had experienced some of it, but had escaped it. Moved to the United States. I think he grew up in Chicago. And in recent years was just plagued with the question, how could it have happened? How could the Holocaust have happened in Germany and Poland? And so he and his son went back, and they went to the very places where he had lived, and they talked to people in the community, and they asked questions about what did you know about what was going on, and what were your feelings about the Jews? And he explores all kinds of questions. The thing that becomes painfully obvious over the course of this many-hour presentation is that the Holocaust was not something that Hitler did. The Holocaust was something that the whole society did. If Hitler had not had hundreds of thousands of people who were either eagerly willing to do his bidding or at least willing to be complicit in what he did, it would never have happened. The whole society did it. And I think we need, as Americans, we tend to think of ourselves as we just do our own thing. Everybody's an individual, we do our own thing, and the rest of society, they're kind of out there to provide me with manufactured goods and that sort of thing, but we aren't really connected any more than I want to be connected with them. That's an attitude that is only true in, that we only have in America, and it's not even true in America. There are places in the world where people will say, if you live apart from society, you are not fully a human being. That's certainly the Russian perspective. Their perspective is, society is a unit, and we all play a role in that thing. And to the extent that we are not a part of that unit, we are not really what we are meant to be. We aren't really fully human beings. We are social creatures. And as social creatures, we're a lot like sheep. I've watched our sheep out in the field. It's a very interesting thing to behold. Why is it that sheep move around the pasture in a group? Why don't they all spread out and do their own thing? They don't like to be separate. They're social animals. So they stay in a herd. That's very nice when you're loading them up to take them to the slaughterhouse. Because if you can get one to go on the truck, they'll all go on. They don't care if it's the slaughterhouse. They just want to be together. And there's an interesting dynamic that happens. If you don't have a very brave ram, our last ram was very brave and he would just do his own thing and the rest of them would all follow. But if you don't have that, if you have a less dominant ram or you've just got ewes and you're trying to get them into the truck, it's a very interesting negotiating process. The ewe will take the dominant ewe will take a few steps forward, but we'll kind of be looking back to see if the others are coming. Because if they aren't, then that ewe's going to start getting nervous. But if they're coming, the ewe goes, well, I'll take another two steps. And so if you can get them all kind of, it's a negotiation process that happens between the leader and the rest of the herd. And if you can kind of get the leader to go and the herd to say, yeah, that's okay, then you can get them all into the truck. But if that leader goes too far and the rest of the herd bolts, that leader's going to go too. That leader won't go on the truck. We're like that. I don't think it's an accident that in the Bible people are frequently likened to sheep. So when you have a leader in a human society, that leader cannot go just anywhere he wants to go. There's a negotiation process that takes place. The leader says, we're going to cut taxes, right? And looks back to see whether people are going to go for it or not. We're going to raise taxes, right? And see if they're following. If they aren't, that leader, doesn't matter how bold, even if it's Nicholas I, and that was before the French Revolution, before kings lost their heads, Nicholas I was even a little nervous about, will they come? And so he could not go just anywhere he wanted to go. So leadership in a human society, I'm convinced, is a negotiated process. And the leader can only go where people are willing to go with him. So that's true even in a hereditary monarchy, that the leadership ends up reflecting society as a whole. There is a closer connection than we as Americans would like to think. So they are being punished then for the abuse of power on the part of their leaders, which they are complicit in. They allowed it to happen. If the society of Judah as a whole had been adamant, we will not allow our rulers to violate the principles of justice, it would not have happened. I feel fairly confident of that. So then, the punishment that is being inflicted upon the people of Judah is God is saying, you and your leaders abandoned the principles of justice. And the principles of justice are those things that provide the framework for leadership of society as a whole. In other words, you have abandoned the authority that I have established and the principles that are based on my authority. And that is true leadership. You've abandoned that? Okay, you get what you asked for. You will be ruled by children. You will be ruled in a way that has no principle. And that will be chaos. So the punishment then is a very fitting punishment for the crime. By not acknowledging God's authority and his principles and his leadership, they will get the leadership that they want, which is no leadership. Okay, so that is the first punishment and the first crime. The second punishment, the second crime, verse 16. Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are proud and walk with heads held high and seductive eyes and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles on their feet. That's the crime. And the crime is, on the part of the women of Judah, an arrogance and a flirtatiousness, an immodesty. And because of that, there's going to be a punishment, and the punishment fits the crime, starting with verse 17. Therefore the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads bare. In that day the Lord will take away the beauty of their ankles, headbands, crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, amulets, finger rings, nose rings, festal robes, outer tunics, cloaks, money purses, hand mirrors, undergarments, turbans, and veils. Now it will come about that instead of sweet perfume, there will be a putrefaction. Instead of a belt, a rope. Instead of well-set hair, a plucked-out scalp. Instead of fine clothes, a donning of sackcloth. And branding instead of beauty. Your men will fall by the sword, and your mighty ones in battle. And her gates will lament and mourn, and deserted she will sit on the ground. So because of this arrogance and immodesty, the women will be deprived of every ornament of beauty whatsoever, and they will be enslaved. So they will be greatly humbled then. And here's an interesting turn in the pronouns that are being used. In verse 26, and her gates will lament and mourn. Her gates. And deserted, she will sit on the ground. Now it seems to be talking about not just an individual woman, but rather Jerusalem. It's beginning to depict Jerusalem as this woman who has been, her gates are deserted, she laments and mourns, and she is deserted and sitting on the ground. I think that we have the same dynamic happening here that I talked about with the first crime and the first punishment, and that is, it is not just the women of Jerusalem that will be punished for this. All of Jerusalem, and more fully, all of Judah will be punished for this. Why? Because it's not just the crime of the women. It's the crime of society as a whole. That if society did not countenance this kind of behavior and condone it and encourage it, it wouldn't have happened. So again, I think the theme is the same, that we have crimes, sins committed on the part of a few, which are reflective of the heart of the whole. And those would not happen if we were talking about a healthy society, one that truly honored God. You wouldn't have these kinds of things happening. As a result, all of Jerusalem and Judah is going to be punished. And the punishment will be a humbling and a desertion. They will be left alone and sitting in the dust. So I think what we have in this chapter is he's pointing out two examples of the wickedness of Judah, for which Judah is going to be punished. And in each case, he picks out a specific manifestation of Judah's wickedness. The first one, it is Judah's abandonment of true authority and true leadership. And the punishment for that is going to be God's withdrawal of any leadership and turning them over to chaos and the caprice of children who will arbitrarily rule over them. The second crime that he points out is the crime of the women, their arrogance and their immodesty. And the punishment is going to be to greatly humble them and make them absolutely unattractive. But in both cases, both crimes are specific manifestations of the bigger problem, and that is Judah's rebelliousness and abandonment of God's principles. And that is ultimately what they are being punished for. So it's really important for us to realize that. I think it's kind of sobering in our in the current debate that's happening with respect to our president and his troubles. I am confident that the sins of our leaders have occurred because we as a society have allowed it to happen and indeed encouraged it to happen. And in fact, it seems to me that there is an undercurrent in our society of a certain amount of pride in what Clinton has done and gotten away with. And I think we stand back and we say, man, that's, he's pretty slick, what he's been able to do. And it's kind of cute. We've got Bart Simpson as a president. I remember, I am not a faithful fan of Bart Simpson, but I did watch one episode in which he kept repeating this one cute little phrase that really stuck in my mind. He said, "I didn't do it. You didn't see me. You can't prove it." Almost that quickly, moving from one line to the other. And that is, he's moving from fact to what he can get away with. And I think we're seeing that played out, not just in animation. But what's happening, I think, is symptomatic of the state of our society as a whole. We are all contributors to it. There's no question about it. And I can look at ways that I have contributed to what's going on. Some of my attitudes that I have held and have since come to realize are very harmful. But there's a reminder built into this chapter, and we see these reminders from time to time, that although the evils of society are really manifestations of the state of society as a whole, there is also an individual judgment that is coming. We may all suffer for the ills of our society. That may very well happen and probably will happen. But there's a more important issue, and that is there's an individual judgment that is yet to come. And for those who are righteous, it will go well. But for those who are wicked, it will go badly. Questions, comments?
When you started Isaiah, you gave us sort of the historical framework in which it was being written. And Isaiah is writing at the time when the coming problem was the Assyrians coming, decimating the north and doing a fair amount of damage in the south. The Babylonian captivity, we know, didn't happen until 100 and something years, 150 years later, something like that. And it's been a pretty standard thing for people, critics of the book of Isaiah, who don't believe in the authority of the Bible, to think that chapter 40 on must have been written by somebody else down the line, because it talks so much about the Babylonian problem, which is much later than the time when Isaiah was writing. So my question for you here is, you're looking at this section and saying he's not talking about the Assyrians, which are in the time frame that he's writing. He's looking ahead and describing what's going to happen when the Babylonians are coming. My question was, why did you make that decision? decision? Why did you decide that he's talking about the Babylonians, that event so much in the future?
Right. I guess my answer would be it seems to fit the best. But having said that, I'm working on a theory. And my theory is that it is not unlike God to do test runs, that God will predict that X will happen, big X will happen. But it seems like it's not unlike God to have some little X's that approximate and foreshadow the big X that are in between when it's prophesied and when the big X actually happens. And it wouldn't surprise me if the attack of the Assyrians, and in fact they defeated all of Judah except Jerusalem under Sennacherib, that was a little X. But I think in fact this is talking about the Babylonian capture. And the reason that fits the best is when it talks about I will make mere lads their princes, capricious children will rule over them. There were a series of three or four kings that ruled Judah just before Babylon finally came in and took Jerusalem and exported all its leadership. And those three or four kings ruled for short periods of time and were all in their 20s, early 20s when they ruled. So I think that's what it's talking about most specifically.
Am I remembering right when you and I talked about this? You pointed to a passage in Chronicles or something that was sort of similar to that list of the people who were going to be deported.
Right. It's 2 Kings. Let me see. I think I have it written down here. 2 Kings 24:14. Here it's talking about, this is just the historical narrative, talking about the event, the time in which Judah was finally conquered by the Babylonians. And you can read the section preceding this, and it lists the rulers of Judah and how old they were and how long they reigned and what happened during their rule. But here, the deportation, 24... I'll just start at 10. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother and his servants and the captains and his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign, and he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. Then he led away into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and smiths. None remained except the poorest people in the land. So that seems to be describing what we have predicted here in Isaiah, when all the people of leadership, both political leadership as well as economic and social leadership, will be removed. You cut the mic.
You characterized the workings of God as supernatural versus natural. And from God's point of view, there really isn't a supernatural versus natural. Do you think that these judgments and crimes and punishments are, from human point of view, natural results of the punishments, the natural results of the crimes, or are they supernatural? And the question I'm really asking, since you've alluded to our country, is, are we to expect a natural consequence from our behavior, or supernatural consequences?
Well, I'm inclined to think that the two are completely merged. One of the things that I have reflected on looking at Isaiah is that And it's not just in Isaiah that we see this. We see descriptions of historical activities happening as though God is calling, for instance, the Assyrians. That he's calling the Assyrians to come to follow the standard. We'll come to those passages later in Isaiah, to follow the standard of and to march in war on Israel. And it's described in a way that is purely supernatural, that God is very overtly has his hands on things and is bringing things to pass. But if you look at the history books, the things that were taking place are all very much like the things that we see happening all over the world. They were very human responses to the situations that they were confronted with. Which means we've got a very interesting situation in which, on the one hand, these acts of God can be looked at as the product of, it can be looked at like political science, and it makes sense. But at the same time, it's God acting. So the two are married so closely that I'm convinced they're the same thing. And that we can see God's activity, but we can describe it in political science terms. If we think about what was happening when Judah and Israel split, on the one hand, it's a spiritual consequence of the sins of Solomon. But on the other hand, it's a very natural outworking of the kinds of dynamics we see in societies all over the world. So you can look at it theologically, or you can look at it through the eyes of a political scientist. But it's the same thing. They're married. It's the same thing. So I think we see God acting in a way that we recognize as being the way things work. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
I saw some... Check.
You were talking about a society, for example, Germany, being complicit in Hitler's crimes. The thing that comes to mind is the implicit expectation there is that we don't want to be complicit in any crimes of our culture and our nation. How does one not be complicit? I mean, you give some thought to that. One view is we need to protest. We need to become socially and politically active and put a stop to all this and put an end to this. It seems like the other possible answer is we just need to clean up our own lives and provide a model for someone who loves justice and who loves truth and who loves righteousness and godliness, and proclaim that message to other people, and they will or they will not follow. But of those two, or is there a third option? How do we not be complicit?
I am so convinced that the driving force behind social change is the spiritual life of people in a nation that I guess I would take the same approach to this that I would take to evangelism, and that is I need to evangelize myself first, and then as I have opportunity present the gospel to others. And I think it's a similar kind of thing here, that I need first of all to deal with my own soul and pray that God would make my own soul right and to strive after what is right. And then teach those around me, my family, my friends, any way that I can, help lead them, encourage them to do likewise. And as we have opportunity, be like the little boy in Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale, The Emperor in the New Clothes. And that we need at times to say, but he's naked. At times we need to say, but that's garbage. That's wrong. That's wicked. And to the extent that people are receptive to such a message, that should work. To the extent that they are not receptive to such a message, I don't think it would matter what kind of bat you brought out to beat them over the head with. So I guess that's my pragmatic approach to that. One more question.
Another way of saying that is that we as the church need to become prophets. And prophets are never entirely popular. I think the greatest of the prophets, anyone remember who that was? John the Baptist. For a while there, he was getting just droves of people to come out to be baptized. The remission of sins, you know, in other words, the way we would say it, as they were out there today. He was getting lots of people to go out and clean up their act, their personal lives. I think another historical parallel would be the great English revival of the 18th century, the same history that France was going to the tumult and a horrible, uncivilized rebellion, which many, many people were killed, and the whole country was thrown into a turmoil for a generation. At that same point, England was undergoing the revival under the Wesley brothers and Whitfield. A very different result came, and they experienced a generation of good leadership. Now, you have to be careful when you use these things as illustrations, as I often do in evangelism, because it wasn't a golden age, it didn't work perfectly. All you have to do is read Dickens, and you see that there was plenty of rottenness left. But compared to what it would have been, it was a dramatic difference. It shows the power of the gospel to transform society by transforming individual people. Because the Wesleys reached entire classes of people who never heard the gospel. The Welsh coal miners, Irish people, the poorer classes who often were just left unhelped by the traditional church. But my question, I guess, along with this would be, how does the church